Welcome to the Learning Well podcast, where we take learning seriously, but not ourselves.
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Learning Well podcast. Today, we're talking to Dr. Daryl Meekins.
Hi. Good to be here.
Daryl's a longtime friend of the podcast, and he brings a lot of international learning experience, and we're going to dig into all of that in just a little bit. So, but today, our topic is pandemic-proofing your course. And there's a lot of things in that title to make you think. We're going to try and unpack what those mean exactly. But Daryl has a lot of experience in academia, higher ed, some corporate experience as well, and has just been sort of thinking on these topics. And they're very timely no matter what world you're living in. I think the tips and just the conversation we have is going to be super helpful. So, Daryl, I don't want to say start at the beginning, but maybe tell us a little bit about how you even got involved in education and learning and development.
Sure. Yeah. I think for me, it started with my work in the majority world, global south, particularly in Africa, and thinking about how education really just has the opportunity to change people's life. It changes the trajectory of their life completely. And I saw firsthand how people who had access to education versus those that did not, how their lives just turned out completely differently. And it literally became a life or death kind of situation for them.
Yeah.
So for me, I've always saw that as quite inspiring in the sense of being able to provide opportunities for people. And over the years, have just committed myself to trying to help individuals, you know, from a faculty, from a teaching perspective, but then also from an administrative and structural perspective, to think about how institutions can be more effective in maximizing those outputs. And been able to do that internationally for a while now, which is a great privilege to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hadn't mentioned to our listeners, but you have experience from like actual boots on the ground yourself as a faculty member designing courses, then working with faculty members, but you also have some higher ed administrative experience. So like you said, that structural and understanding what has to be in place and what works and what's not working right now.
Mm, yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because even though contexts vary quite a lot, the questions people are asking are the same. So I just got back from 2 weeks in South Africa and working with a group out there that is thinking about how they could develop more competent individuals for life and just being able to create an adaptive skill set that can sort of future-proof themselves in a way, you know, so that they're not bound to a particular type of industry but can develop skills that can transfer across multiple industries. And I think that's more and more the conversation people are having today is how can they use education in a more utilitarian fashion than we've seen in the past. But maybe we'll get into some of that today.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So less of a sort of traditional diploma or like course of study and more really practical life skills. And this is, I should mention, this is in an online or e-learning context, correct? Or is it a little bit of both?
I think it's a little bit of both, depending on where you find yourself. But definitely, as we know, the conversation that we often have is in the area of online learning and distance learning, because that is the metric that is rising the fastest. And particularly out of what we've come out of the last couple of years, it's on everyone's radar at the moment, how to do that more effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the values you're going to bring. And we can talk about pandemic-proofing your course with a distinctly North American viewpoint, but what I'm hoping I know you'll bring is that, I mean, that international flavor that I think there's things we don't think about. And then also, like you said, some of the issues are the same no matter where you are. So it'll be an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Sounds great.
Yeah. So I think to start with, like we talked about the title is Pandemic Proofing Your Course, but maybe let's define course a little bit, because we do have a variety of listeners, and I know I've worked with you in the corporate setting and also higher ed, and I still remember some of my early struggles for people in the corporate world to understand a course. It has a totally different meaning. That's like a 15-minute module to them, kind of a standalone interactive video type thing, and in today, you know, it's much more, but as opposed to kind of a university course. And those of our listeners that are used to that kind of format, you know, a week's worth of material, so to speak, with interactivity. And so can you kind of define for us what you're thinking of?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think for me and my world, I'm particularly vested in university education. So your typical programs of study, which can be certificate programs, which are typically sort of a year or so long, or your degree programs, which, you know, as we know, is typically 3 to 4 years. And these days accelerated much more. But then within those programs, you have, you know, discrete courses that students have to take. And those typically range in the online space, particularly from 6 or 7 weeks to about 14 or 15 weeks per course. And so, yeah, that's sort of the ballpark in which I tend to play the most. But yeah, it's interesting when you talk about the terminology, because that varies across the world as well. So,
okay. Yeah, tell us about that then.
Yeah, so just got back from South Africa, and it's interesting because the terms vary, and what is in most other contexts or many other contexts, a module of study would be a entire course, whereas here that typically is a week in a course. You take, you know, certain modules make up the entire course. So just getting those mixed up from time to time as I was talking to people, you know, and it's like, oh yes, I have to remind myself the terms aren't always interchangeable. But also within the corporate space, you know, people will talk about a module a little bit differently than you do in higher ed. So yeah, it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's half the battle sometimes is just aligning our terminology and figuring out what we're talking about. But I think it is important here because we're going to talk about how to pandemic-proof your course. And I just want to make sure our listeners understand we are talking about more of like a semester-long course or, you know, what if it's adult learning, it might be an accelerated 6-7 weeks. But that being said, I don't want those, you know, in the corporate L&D space just to zone out on us here because a lot of these principles still apply. Because we often have courses that we might offer like a leadership program in a corporate setting or sales training or communication skills. So these items would still, these tips you're going to give are still going to apply. So regardless of what space you're in, I think it's going to be important to kind of stretch our minds and think about ways that we can pandemic proof them because it's not going away. So
Absolutely. Yep.
All right. So first of all, tell us, well, I'm gonna make kind of a silly statement. What started you thinking about pandemic proofing your course, which is obviously very dumb because of, you know, there's a pandemic. But you had mentioned to me that it was on your mind, like it's something you've been chewing on. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, the pandemic that we've just gone through, I don't know, can we say we're at the end of it yet?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Right.
We'll just follow the Europeans' lead on this one and say that it's over. I think, you know, when we started down this road and everybody suddenly turned to the emergency remote, let's freak out and try to figure out how we can do this in a distributed format. In some ways, that settled the debate that had still been somewhat lingering in the space of education with regards to whether or not things can be done online or certain things had to be face-to-face. You know, all of a sudden, that option was taken away. And so people who previously were very skeptical and on the fence, if nothing else, about whether or not it could be used in their discipline or in that format, well, now they were doing it, right?
Because there's no choice, yeah.
There's no choice. Yeah. And so what it started me thinking about it was having conversations with faculty about this and thinking through, well, we just don't want them to think this is the best way to do it. You know, so for me, having been involved in good quality online learning for some time, was concerned that this pandemic, in a sense, would settle one debate, but it would create another in saying that, oh, yes, we know what online is. That's when I stand in front of a camera and lecture for 2 hours instead of standing in front of a group of students and lecture for 2 hours. And what we would say to that is that neither of those are good practices. So it's not engaging. It doesn't invoke curiosity in the learner and all those kinds of things. And so it was really about saying, okay, so how can we create a classroom space then we will never go back to what it was. Mm-hmm. And I think most conversations I'm in these days, people realize that we will never go back to what it was pre-pandemic. There'll always be some version of a hybridized, high-flex, whatever terminology we want to use to describe it. But adaptive is the key. And so how do we do that intentionally as opposed to saying, well, if plan B and plan C have to happen, how do I do that, right? So for me, that's been a large part of what's consumed my thinking over the past 6 months or so is to say, how can we actually do this intentionally? And I think there are some ways in which we can do that for sure.
Yeah, and we've talked about that on this podcast prior. That was kind of our big fear, was that this, what I call emergency learning, I mean, that somehow, like you said, it created a different crisis. People began to assume that that's what online learning was this emergency form. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time, like, probably just, I don't know, screaming into the darkness, like, no, nobody was listening. But that's not. I mean, there's ways to do very high quality, lots of interaction, lots of good quality, engaging teaching that can happen online. Mm-hmm. And that's the last thing we want, is for people to somehow get sort of that almost like, well, I guess I have to settle because this is it. Mm-hmm. This is the best there is. And that's not the case at all. So that's partly why I'm excited about our conversation today, to highlight for our listeners, like, it doesn't have to be that way. Fully understanding an emergency is an emergency. You do whatever you can in the time, right? You put a Band-Aid on it. You do the best you can. But what I hope is that at least some faculty learned in the process that maybe it wasn't as hard as they thought it was. Maybe it enhanced portions of their actual classroom teaching. And we'll talk about some of that. But you brought up, like we talked about, adaptive. We're going to talk about multimodal, those kinds of things, like beginning to design courses with a bigger picture in mind now that we know this isn't going away. Mm. So I think it's a real mindset shift, but I just really hope that our listeners understand emergency learning isn't the best that there is, and we need to now move on past that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's maybe a first step in the right direction, in the sense of dispelling the myth that good teaching cannot occur in a distributed space for those that needed to sort of get around that. Mm. But yeah, absolutely. It needs to be done with the same, if not greater, sense of thought that goes into compiling any great course. And that is really thinking about the critical outcomes that you want to see happen. And as we always say, you know, good design is backwards design. And, mm-hmm. and that is really starting with the end in mind about what you want to see students accomplish. And for, I think, a decent amount of folks, especially in higher ed, and I'd say even more especially in postgraduate higher ed, there is a sense in which they just need to pick it up somehow through the program or through the certificate that they're taking, that these are the essential outcomes without being explicit about it. And it's about making explicit what is maybe implicit in the content. And the more you do that, that more dexterity that gives you then. So that sort of leads into this conversation of pandemic proofing, is just about having that dexterity in your presentation styles, and how students can actually learn that content. And I think, you know, a big part of that is realizing, and I think you've mentioned it before in this podcast, that knowledge is out there, so students can attain knowledge. But how do they make meaning of that knowledge? That's where they really need their instructors and their professors to come to the fore and help them make sense of it all. But it's no longer the concept attainment piece that's really necessary in education.
Yeah, I want to go back to two things you said there. So I think, first of all, I love the word, like, the dexterity you're talking about. That's a great term, I think, to help faculty understand. And I was thinking, even in my own experience, I adjunct faculty, and before that, like, high school teacher, making online materials, I don't think I ever thought of it as a skill. To me, it was like survival. If I'm going to take all this time, I mean, it's back in the day where you're like recording your own, making your own interactive video, whatever it might be, I'm going to make sure this is going to last for a while. And I'm going to use it in my classroom, and I'm going to use it online, because I don't have the time to go back and redo this every year, or every 2 months, or that's kind of the talk about, like, evergreen materials, that sort of thing. But I think for, again, most of our faculty friends, they go to school in a specific subject area. And so all of this, you know, educational, like, theory and understanding of how that's not something we shouldn't expect them to understand that. But I think that word dexterity is a kind of a simple concept to wrap your mind around. Like, whatever you're making, you're getting better at being nimble and creating materials that will work across any kind of platform.
Yeah, I think that nimbleness is important. And, you know, to be honest, K-12 educators who transition into instructional design have a much easier time at this.
Because, I found that, yeah.
Because they've had to do it for so many years. And it's the higher ed folks that tend to struggle more, you know. So we in a sense have to catch up with educators who've been doing this for years. If you can teach a child at various stages certain concepts in different ways, you're way ahead of the game.
Well, I think when you're standing up in my own experience in front of 30 freshmen who did not pay to be there and would rather be anywhere else, you're agile really fast or you die. So, but that's a great point. And I think one of the things I've always appreciated about you, though, is like your willingness to come alongside faculty. And I've also seen like great joy when you work with faculty and you help them understand that. They get excited about it, too. And they understand like, okay, I have some, they start to see the value of it, even though, like you said, maybe they're pushed over the edge a little bit by this. It was a very stressful time, but I'm hopeful, and I've seen a lot of sort of change of attitudes, or at least some early embracing now of, okay, this might not be as bad, and where can I go from now, which is great. That's what we're looking for, openness at this point.
So. Yeah, openness and just a realization that things are changing. I mean, the academy and higher ed changes at a slower rate than the corporate space, as you know, so we're a good sort of 3 to 5 years behind in that sense. It's a slow-moving ship, and there's reasons for that, accreditation and the like. You can't just change on a dime. But at the same time, people realize that their students, and we'll probably touch on this, the students are more competitive than ever before in the sense that they are competing, we are competing with them for that market. They are able to have more choices than they ever had before. There's alt credentials, there's different ways in which they can get education, which maybe a generation or so ago just wasn't open to them. So schools, I think, are realizing that they have to appeal to students and give them a reason, a compelling reason to attend. And online education is often a key to that because it allows them that freedom of movement. You know, I work a lot, especially with healthcare degrees and things like that, where these are working individuals. They don't have time to take a couple of years off to go and sit in an undergraduate class somewhere. They need to take this online. Because they're working and because they're busy, and it needs to be convenient. It needs to be at a pace that they can actually complete the program in, and engaging, very real-world relevant. If they can't use it almost immediately, it's useless to them. You know, so they're not at the stage where they're just wanting to get information for the sake thereof. It needs to be very applicable. So I think people are more and more realizing that their programs have to meet those minimum standards and be accessible to what students need.
Well, I'm actually glad you brought that up because I couldn't think of what my second point was I said earlier, and it reminded me. So, you know, you were talking about faculty members, like the knowledge is out there. And I think especially when you're talking here about like adult learners, you know, in the healthcare field or any adult learning field, adults know that. The knowledge is out there. They recognize it. They can pick up their phone and probably find out information from a faculty member who maybe has more credentials at a university that's more prestigious than the one they're at right now. At any time, just Googling on their phone. But your point is, and this will always be the case, that the faculty have the amazing opportunity to help make meaning out of that and to help apply if they do it correctly. So I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask you are already in there now, but like, are students driving this change to a certain degree? And I think they are, to your point, you know, with adult learners there.
I think especially that's true in the adult learner post-grad space. You know, what I'm seeing more and more is the trend towards certificates, stackable credentials, where students can actually choose the matrix in which they actually complete a degree program. They have much more choice than they've had before. So it's an interesting you know, space to play in right now because there's still that need and desire, especially amongst the top tier universities. Their brand is why students go there.
Right.
And that's probably not going to change, right? There's other things aside from the education that you get as a benefit from attending those places. But at the same time, students really are compelled and wanting to know, how can I actually use this to get a better job or to get better at my job? It's no longer a matter of just assuming and assimilating a bunch of content because it may help me somewhere down the line. It's got to be applicable. So I think to that degree, you know, programs are needing to demonstrate the real world applicability, the immediate connection to the job market.
Yeah.
But then also I think the way in which content is put together, you know, faculty are needing to be more creative with how they produce assets for students to consume. And whether we like it or not, I know there's probably people on both sides of the fence on this one. But students also are in a world today where they're consuming media 24/7. They're consuming social media, they're consuming videos on YouTube, all those kind of things. And so the last thing they want is to see a really poorly produced video asset in a course or something like that. It just turns them right off. So there is definitely a need for higher level of production, higher fidelity production in what faculty are doing. And even that word production scares some folks.
Yeah, for sure.
Because they think, I'm not in the entertainment business.
Right.
But I tend to think you kind of are in some ways, you know, that you do want to keep students compelled, interested, engaged, and, you know, why not also call it entertained? Why not also say to them that we want you to feel like this was worth your time and you actually enjoyed being part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, I mean, certainly there's an element of some faculty who really are like the true researcher kind of aspect, but most people don't go into education for the dollars. There's that. There's usually some sort of altruistic, and a lot of it has to do with either love of their subject, which they're excited to share, or, you know, love of the student and or both. And I think you're right. And we, you know, throw the word around like edutainment, but we've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about learning science, and you can maybe say entertainment in a disparaging way, but the fact is that when your brain is engaged, you learn better, you retain it better. And we don't need to go into all that right now, but you're right. And then, you know, we were just talking about like adults who have very little time and they want to, they see opportunities to, you know, why would I sit in this traditional program when I can stack my credential, I can get what I need. So there's an impatience, or at least a desire to have it personalized. And then you look at the undergrad students who, like you said, they're living in this social media TikTok world. There's no way, you know, they're going to sit there for a 2-hour lecture, a 1-hour lecture, a 20-minute lecture. There does not. And so learning how to adapt to that while still there's obviously value in the expertise that the faculty member brings, and that will never go away. But creating a space where students do feel like it's engaging and there's a motivation to stay and to learn. I do think, I say this because I have a student who's a junior at a university. So then listening to like his peers talk and things, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you think like 5 years ago, the average undergrad student would have been thrilled to like not go to class, to wear their pajamas, just to show up online and, you know, not have to worry about being there or, you know, like, right. Like there's more important things to do at college than get dressed and go to class. And the interesting thing I've heard is that a lot of them are saying now, like, or their parents are saying, we paid a lot of money and we're getting an online course. And then to your point, the online course is not very good. And there's actually been in Michigan, I know like a pretty big migration of students from some schools to other schools because that big name they were getting, like they're not even getting that experience now because they're not living on campus and those faculty aren't producing course, or there's just not, I get it. There aren't university resources to help them create this dynamic, you know, highly interactive online class. And they're saying, well, if I'm going to go somewhere else where I'm not going to pay as much, there's a big shift. That's coming. But it was interesting to me that undergraduate students in particular, you just sort of have that image, but they do care and they're paying money. And if, you know, they want to have an engaging experience, and I think in a good way, a swing back a little bit to understanding the value of education for them.
Yeah. And I think you touched on, I think one of the important reasons why there is that sort of pushback. And I think it's because they're not seeing a like for like an apples for apples comparison between maybe what they received on campus versus what they received online. I think that's a direct result of the poor adaptation during the remote space that that we saw, an implementation structure that was designed on the moment instead of intentional. And whenever that's the case, you know, it's always hit and miss. So I think, you know, we probably don't yet have enough good information about sort of the apples for apples comparisons.
Right, we don't.
And that would be interesting to see if there would still be that sense of wanting to return to the quote-unquote traditional campus for the education piece, because mm-hmm. we also understand students want to go to campus
it's social.
For other reasons.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's an interesting dynamic that I think we'll unpack in the days ahead as well.
Yeah, so let's get into some really practical ideas of how to, because I think any listener of this podcast knows, and I know, Daryl, I've worked with you for a long time. We have both worked with faculty and or been faculty. So it is not our intent to, we understand the stress of the emergence. And I first online course I designed, and it had to be done in a certain amount of days and quickly. And I mean, fortunately I'd had some experience, right, curating content, and I was able to do that. But it's not our intention to bash the emergency situation. It was what it was, and it had to happen, and people were so flexible. But now that we have this opportunity maybe to improve things, and I hope encourage faculty that there is this voice online and their ability to share their experiences and make meaning, and how do we help them do that? So, and again, for those of you that are in the corporate space, this is not isolated to higher ed. I mean, we made a lot of emergency corporate learning that was the best we could do at the time. In fact, we had a whole, I think, article we wrote, like super fast tips to make things. But now we have an opportunity. The interesting thing, though, in the corporate space is that we've read a couple different studies. I think one of them said that corporate learning budgets for this year were expected to go up by 57% because the CFO, the CEO suddenly is able to see the return on investment. In the higher ed space, there's not that budgetary, there's not that increase because they don't have that capability. But still, these ideas, I think, are helpful across. So why don't you give us some of your best ideas? I know there's some things you've done yourself or things you've seen done that have been so effective.
Yeah, and I will say that I think budgets for online are increasing across the board.
Good, okay.
There's definitely a sense in which people realize, as I said earlier, that you're not going to go back to 2019. There's been a change that's now sort of been put in place that's not going to go back. It's just a question of how now at this point. And I think
there's that, yeah.
Yeah, and I think for me, it comes back to what we said a little bit earlier as well. One of the key things is to realize that, good design takes time. And it's probably a good shout out to talk to the fact that instructional design is always, I think, a key part of this conversation. So for institutions that have access to that and are able to make use of the services of IDs is, I think, really instrumental these days, because to your point earlier, I mean, people are busy teaching, they have other responsibilities. And so to take a bird's eye view of a course or a particular program is difficult to do. And to have somebody alongside you who's sort of a peer, who can be a guide on the side, if you will, is really, really helpful. So as much as people can take advantage of that, I would suggest that.
Let me stop you for 1 second. So where would they, I'm just trying to think of names. Like I know, so some universities, like it might be called like their learning center, their learning and development center. Sometimes it resides in the IT department, or although not really, but like, can you just throw out some common names of where those resources would be found?
Yeah, it's actually a good point, because it varies quite significantly. So I think a lot of universities have teaching and learning centers. So
okay, that's the name I was looking for, yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the Office of Learning and Teaching, and sometimes the Office of Teaching and Learning. So, but if the university space is big enough to actually have a separate, distinct office for that, then that's usually where those folks would reside, and most likely people would have had contact with them already.
Right, they should have, yes.
If they don't, some smaller schools tend to have, just one or two individuals on staff who can help with that kind of thing. And so certainly it's about trying to find out what resources are available to you. And then, of course, there are a plethora of outside companies and that who can partner with the universities to provide them that necessary capacity if they don't have it, which is more and more common these days as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the bulk of I wouldn't say the bulk, but of our university work, you know, but we engage differently. And sometimes it's just a jump start too, right? Like, just can you help us get it off the ground? Sometimes it's we're launching a new program, but you're right. I mean, accessing those resources is super important. And sometimes, you know, larger universities have more of them, unfortunately, but I would say unfortunately for the smaller universities, but tapping into that, if you are a faculty member, I would greatly encourage that. Even if it's maybe just a 1 hour, can somebody help you sit down and sort of look through your course and your objectives and offer some suggestions?
Yeah, but I think to your point earlier too, that you don't necessarily need that. I think if those resources are not available to you, there's some things you could do. And I think the first thing is really important is to identify what are the key competencies that you would like to see in a student who completes a particular course of study or a particular program that you might be heavily invested in. So, you know, what does a student need to know and understand in order to be effective, right? Mm-hmm. That sort of phrase is really helpful. And the more you start thinking about that as an individual for a course that I'm teaching, then I start to think about, I would like them to be able to do these list of things as I think about it. And the more I do that, then I can start thinking about, well, what goes into that? What kind of acquisition do they have to have of facts? What kind of comprehension of those facts must they have in order to be able to use it effectively? And that's when we start to think about backwards design in terms of how you're going to assess those things, what kind of discussions need to take place. And so that's all the mapping that takes place in developing a good course, right? Mm-hmm. And you can do that on your own as an individual, as a faculty member, or you can, you know, utilize a team of people around you. There's templates you can get online and things like that that people can use. And I think that's the first most important step, because what that enables you to do is then say, well, if these are the certain competencies I'd like to see, then how they can be achieved is, you know, probably multiple ways in which I can see them doing that and assessing them doing that. So if I'm teaching on Zoom, or if I'm teaching face-to-face, or if I'm teaching hybrid, or if I'm using different technologies within an LMS or something like that, I can still assess all of those things. And that's the multimodal piece.
Right.
So that students can access that content in various ways. And why that's advantageous for a faculty member is you just never know what's around the corner.
You don't.
You don't know what is going to be asked of you, what's going to be required of the institution, what the industry is going to do that's going to cause you to pivot. And so you want to be ready in saying, you know what, I still can achieve these same outcomes with students. I'm just going to do it over here or over there. And so the mode matters less than the actual functionality of what my course is supposed to be teaching. So I think that's really the key thing I would say to people who are thinking about this.
No, you are preaching to the choir. So we've spent an awful lot of time on this podcast talking about whether it's curriculum mapping or whatever term you choose to use for it. And there are lots of free templates online. But the point is, you slow down at the beginning to speed up at the end. And I think it's exactly what you said. Like, we tend to jump to modality. Like, I'm going to deliver it with this, or I wrote a textbook, I did these series of videos. Therefore, I'm going to use them, as opposed to, what are the competencies for the course? What do I need to assess at the end? And then in the middle, I decide, how am I going to deliver that?
Yeah.
And, I think one of the best experiences, although it was very stressful for me, my very first year teaching high school, I was told that the textbooks were out of date and there were going to be no textbooks. Well, back then, traditional model was chapter one, you marched your way through the textbook, and that's how you designed your lesson plans. And I think for faculty that have written their own books in particular, that's still a kind of a format. Well, we had just adopted statewide standards. And so I didn't have a choice, and I didn't know what I was doing at the time. But instead of marching my way through a textbook, I looked at the standards, and then I looked at what I needed to assess. And, you know, early days of the internet, I started looking, and pretty soon I found videos and resources and materials I never could have made on my own. And started, we use that word curating, right? And I understand for faculty, it's very important that things are rigorous and that they, but there's still stuff out there they can use. And that also frees them up, I think, then to say, okay, but here's a specific topic that I have a lot of expertise in. I really want my students to be able to make meaning of it. And I'm going to devote my time and effort. If I do have to produce something, this is the key point of the course. I'm going to produce, whether it's a video or whatever the materials might be that they can use in any way then.
Mm. Yeah, and there's often so much time in a course that we end up wasting, you know. There's so much time that students can spend actually doing their own research and doing their own mm-hmm. thinking. What they really need you as a faculty for is to help them put it all together. And that really probably takes less time than you think. Mm-hmm. You spend so much time in creating resources, you know, creating a video that could probably been better communicated through a TED talk, you know.
Absolutely. With an expert, somebody that probably knows more than I do. Yeah.
And it's probably better produced and all the rest of that. So, you know, instead of me just re-recording something that they probably could have gotten somewhere else in a better way, let me spend my time actually thinking through how I can help them understand and connect the dots between concepts and ideas so that they can go and create new concepts and ideas mm-hmm. and create that new knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think especially coming back to the postgraduate space, you know, I think that more and more is what students are demanding mm-hmm. because their industry is demanding mm-hmm. it. You know, there's a constant push towards innovation and change and new ideas. And so if they're not taught how to think that way, where are those new ideas and innovations going to come from? Well, what we see in society is they often come from people who have not gone through the higher education space, right? And that's unfortunate because they should be being taught critical thinking and engagement and questioning knowledge and creating new knowledge and things like that, but they're often not. And so it's left to people who are completely outside of that to actually do that. And I don't think it's by accident. I think it's by the system that has been created that we need to, you know, change the way in which faculty see their role mm-hmm. in the classroom space. And of course, you know, people listening to this who are educators and have been doing this for a while, you know, if as a teacher and as a faculty member, as a professor, you know what good teaching looks like. Mm-hmm. And you know when you've made that genuine connection with students, when those aha moments are happening online or in person. Mm-hmm. And so what we want is a collection of those aha moments. I mean, wouldn't it be great if our whole class was a collection of those times instead of that, oh, there was that one time that students seemed to get it, you know? And so I think that can be deliberate. It doesn't have to be an accidental thing, but it does take more forethought up front. And what I've heard from faculty who've actually gone through the process and have, in a sense, been willing to reinvent themselves.
Right. That's a great way to explain it. Yeah.
Yeah. They've actually come back at the end and say, you know, it's preparing to teach an online class in this way, even though I might have been a little, you know, trepidatious about it. Now that I've gone through it, it's made me a better on-campus teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, I take those same ideas and I actually bring them into my classroom and I bring these ideas and we do more group work now and things like that. So it's actually made them a better educator all round. And so that's a win-win for everybody in that case. The faculty who gets better and the students who get a better education as a result.
I actually hear that exact same thing, because in an online course, if you're mapping to your objectives and then, you know, making sure you're there's a lot of stuff that faculty in a classroom setting, you know, and I get it. They're telling their anecdotal stories and there's value in that, or it's a pet project, but when they're really forced to sit down and measure those to the objectives, like you said, there's a lot of fluff that could go out. And like, I'm thinking about what you're talking about. So a faculty member, rather than spending a lot of time producing like a 1-hour lecture, they'd be better served designing a project that students are working on. And then once all those are turned in, or maybe papers, mm-hmm. whatever, hosting a live Zoom session where they're unpacking what they're seeing from their students and discussing with them, like, why did you do this in the project? And this is what I've seen. And what was your thinking? Or trying to connect. Back in the day, I used to always tell faculty, online discussions get really bad raps and they can be done very poorly. But I also say to faculty, this is your opportunity. Mm. Be in there as students are talking, you know, write good questions and then interact with them and share ideas. And that's your opportunity there, as opposed to maybe producing that content, like you said, that could be found somewhere else. Mm.
And I think also leveraging, this is one of the other things that I think faculty have learned, is that you can leverage your students in the online space much differently than you can in a face-to-face classroom. So students can help each other. They can do that asynchronously through sort of a Q&A discussion area where they can allow their own individual expertise to shine.
Yeah, you know? Especially adult learners. I mean, that's actually absolutely. A key point to those courses.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's not just a sort of top-down approach to learning.
Yes.
It is a community. Mm-hmm. And I've heard from a number of students who said that they felt a greater sense of community in the online space mm-hmm. than they did in an on-campus space. And again, not simply because the course was online. So that's the mistake sometimes people make.
Right, right.
But if it's done well and it's done intentionally, then people actually get to know each other in a much, much deeper way than sitting in a classroom of 300 students. There's a lot of advantage there.
Yeah, yeah. You're bringing me back to one of my favorite catchphrases, which is there's no back seats in an online course. Mm. Like everyone has to be involved. And I think especially, I mean, that's the hallmark, a characteristic of adult learners. They bring their own expertise and they want to learn from each other. And your job as faculty really is to create those situations.
Yeah, so exactly. So it all comes down to the intentionality of it, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is upfront a different... And I wouldn't say a bigger lift, because I think it's a different kind of lift than it is for students, for faculty who've been traditionally in a face-to-face environment. But it makes you more dexterous, as we were saying earlier. Mm-hmm. It allows you to then teach in a multiple different mm-hmm. modes and methods, and also taking into account the self-directed learner of today. Mm-hmm. These self-directed learners, they are more savvy than ever before. They kind of know what they want. And they also know and can detect when they're not getting
it. Yes, yes.
So, yep. And they'll go somewhere else, you know. So it is a very competitive environment which we find ourselves. And I always try to resist in the higher education space. Anyway, I try to resist the sense of the commodification of it all.
Yeah.
Because it makes me a little uneasy. I do think there is a sense in which, you know, the learning space is somewhat sacred in that sense. But at the same time, we can't ignore the market realities
right.
of where people are at. People are paying for their education. They can pay for it in a number of different ways, a number of different spaces. And so they need to see. It's very vital that they see the immediate benefit and gains, and not just wait for 2 or 3 years and hope they'll pick it up somewhere along the way.
No, that's a very balanced opinion for sure, especially of the current state of higher ed. So before I ask you my final question, I just want to give you opportunity. Any final thoughts? I don't want to cut you off or anything, but I thought I would ask.
No, I mean, I think we're all still learning. I think the more I read and research on these topics, the more I realize that there's a constant evolution in our thinking, and that's probably going to be the way it is. So when people start talking about a settled science when it comes to what's happening with online learning, they're probably not reading widely enough.
Yeah,
because there's obviously counterpoints, and especially internationally as well. There are different views and different opinions that are all backed up with certain segments of data. So I think it's going to take us more time to figure out what ultimately is going to be the best way forward for all of us. But I would say overarchingly, you know, for faculty listening to this especially, I want to encourage them to say that, you know, there's a great opportunity out there for them if they are willing to sort of be a little bit more adaptive in their thinking, and to be able to ultimately make a bigger difference in more lives mm-hmm. if they're able to span across different modes.
Yeah, which I think is the ultimate goal. Mm. So yeah, that's a great way to sum it up for sure. So well, I ask all of our guests, and I did pre-warn you of this, but my favorite thing to ask is just, what are you learning well now? Just one thing, it'd be topic, it can be related to this, it doesn't have to be at all. So, but just share with us, what are you learning well now, and how are you doing that?
I think for me, I tend to dig into a lot of things that people don't like to read. So a lot of boring literature that has a lot of data and statistics attached to them, because I do think the metrics matter. And so for me, I always believe it, just like we've been talking about pandemic proof, you know, mm-hmm. I think staying one step ahead of where the trends are is a really tricky space to be, because mm-hmm. you know, trends are unpredictable mm-hmm. at best. But I think for me, trying to reach people and learn from people, I think of the likes of an Elon Musk, for example, an interesting character, whatever you think of
him.
You know, but someone, again, outside of the realms of traditional higher ed and things like that, and probably quite the antithesis of a lot of that, but yet able to see things that other people cannot see at this point. And I think that sort of visionary sort of approach to education is what's sorely lacking across the board. And so for me, trying to learn and curate ideas from those types of individuals who are able to see those things and learn from that is important for me.
Oh, I love that. So, I mean, it's very disruptive, right? And very. So how do you, like, what's your favorite? Are you watching YouTube videos? Are you watching TED Talks? Are you reading? Like, how? What's your favorite way to kind of explore those things?
Yeah, I guess all of the above, okay. You know, just really seeking out, like I say, you know, reading a little bit about Elon Musk and Simon Sinek and people like that, who I think have sort of some quite revolutionary ideas, and just trying to soak some of those up. I really enjoy Adam Grant as well. I think
yes.
There's a lot of good stuff to say.
Yes, he's on my list, that book. I've got to read it yet before a podcast coming up.
And I think what helps us as educators too is not to read just education-related books.
Sure.
That's the challenge.
For sure.
We think, oh, we need to read the next thing about education because we feel like we have to. But I think also looking outside of our specific industry to say, you know, how can people who succeed in business or in entrepreneurship and things like that, what can we learn from them? Not to emulate that necessarily, but to see what we're missing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I mean, at its heart, like, learning is a curiosity, right? So we have to have a curiosity about lots of things, and that all feeds into what we're doing then. So
totally.
Thank you so much for being on our podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I know you're giving us such great things to think about. I want to thank our listeners too. So we know that your time is a gift, and we really thank you for choosing to spend it with us. Make sure to like, comment, subscribe, rate on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. Thanks so much.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Learning Well podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please leave some feedback on whatever platform you're streaming on. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you in the next episode.